Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Thanks for tuning in to Faith Radio. Thanks for listening to the show. Tell your friends about us. Always interested in making new friends. Pipe down over there, Bill English. I have the power to not bring you on, just so you know. Oh, I have such limited power. Anyway, we have a great hour coming up. Carolyn Custis James, she's written a book called Finding God in the Margins. She talks about the ancient book of Ruth and how it really speaks into today's world with astonishing relevance. The readers of this book encounter refugees, undocumented immigrants, poverty, hunger, women's rights, male power and privilege, discrimination, and injustice. She's done some thinking. She's going to talk about how the book of Ruth is about God, the questions that surface when life kind of falls apart, and how God reaches into the margins and chooses two totally marginalized women who in the eyes of the culture were pretty much zeros, all right? But we all have stories of failure and things that happen in our lives that we feel crushed by, maybe. Disappointed. How do I overcome this? And sometimes failure is a gift. We're going to talk to Bill English about that and some of the things we can learn from failure, because all of us do it. And the question really is, why is it so hard to learn from our failures? That is the topic of conversation with Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. I will take a very short break and bring Bill on in just a minute. Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? 7 minutes after the hour, okay, we all fail. How do we learn from failure? And sometimes we think, is it really failure or is it just my version of failure? Bill English is in studio from BibleandBusiness.com. Good morning, Bill.
Hey, I'm here.
Yes, you are. All of us fail.
Yeah,
so
we do.
And some of us try to use that failure to move forward in life versus retreat and feel depressed and discouraged.
Yeah. Number one reason between the two is that we blame ourselves rather than learning from the failure. And I call blame is the parking brake against the hill of learning.
Okay.
So when you fail and you blame yourself, you might as well just throw in the towel because you're not going to learn from your failure.
Mm-hmm. Do men and women process failure differently?
That I don't know, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
Yeah, thank you.
I assume the answer is yes.
I honestly don't know. I think failure might affect different personalities differently, but I don't know if it's a gender thing.
Mm-hmm. So what value is there in blaming yourself for failure and then choosing not to learn from it?
I don't think there's any value in that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that there's a time for reflection on what you could have done better or what the type of person that you should have been in that situation. But I don't know that blame in and of itself is very helpful. It's more about taking inventory of yourself and your actions and saying, what could I have done better, or how should I have handled myself differently? How should I have thought differently? That kind of thing. That's going to be more helpful. But the actual blame, and I define blame as, I'm woe is me. I'm a terrible person. I'm just a stupid idiot. Why did God put me on this earth? I'm just a piece of human debris.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of self-loathing is not going to get you anywhere.
And it's an affront to God.
It is, because you're telling him that he made a mistake when he made you.
Right, right. I remember a story that I heard. The CEO of IBM at the time, Tom Watson, had an employee that made a mistake that cost the company $2 million. So the guy gets a note to come immediately see him.
Yep.
And he was practically putting stuff in a box because he assumed he was gone. And assuming he was going to be let go, Mr. Watson said, oh, no, I can't let you go now. You're too valuable to me.
Yeah.
I just spent $2 million training you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let you take that experience off to another company. So,
yeah.
You know, we can learn from our mistakes and just to realize that it's not the end of the road, is it?
It's never the end of the road. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of Romans 8:28. God takes all things that happen in our lives and he works them together for good. And these are things, these failures that we have in life, and we all have them, can be used for God's glory and God's good and can help us become better people.
All right, Bill, let's reflect on something maybe you've done wrong. You're at work, you've done something wrong, you're reflecting on it. What steps do you take?
I think the first step you take is to find somebody to process it with, preferably, quite frankly, your manager.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to your manager and you say, hey, I think I screwed up here, mm-hmm. I'd like to talk to you about it, they're going to be far more amenable. What's that word? Amenable? Is that the word? Or open to mm-hmm. hearing, to talking with you about this, than if they hear about that mistake sideways or if they get surprised by it.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one thing that managers hate, it's being surprised. And so if you go to them and say, hey, I think I made this mistake. I want to talk to you about it. And then just tell them what happened in plain terms and then say, you know, what do you think? What should I have done differently? How should I have thought differently? Blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. That's trusting that you think the manager is a safe place to go.
Yeah, the manager may not be a safe place to go.
Right.
If not, then go to a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
If not, go to somebody at church. If not there, go to your wife or husband.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have them, then call us here on the show, and we'll talk to you.
877-933-2484 if you have a question or comment for Bill English. He would be happy to address that. If you're in a situation where you've gone through a little bit of a failure and you don't know what to do, we can process it with you. You can remain anonymous. You can even write me an email, bill@myfaithradio.com, and type out what happened, and we'll discuss it on the air, time permitting. So then we have to avoid similar mistakes or actions in the future, which, how's that work?
Well, that's where you take inventory and you try to change what you did or how you thought or the kind of words that you spoke, and you commit to not doing those things again in the future. But I think it's more than just not doing. I think it's also replacing with, here's what I'm going to do instead. Here's what I'm going to say instead. Here's how I'm going to change my attitude to be better instead. You know, so you don't ever stop. I mean, you know this. You do the addictions show on the weekend. You know you don't stop an addiction by focusing on the addiction and focusing on the stopping of the addictive behavior. Instead, you replace it with mm-hmm. something that's much better.
Right.
So it's along the same lines here with a failure that you might have in your life.
Mm-hmm. What about the blame game? That goes on a lot at work, doesn't it?
It does, and I just choose not to participate in it. It's really easy in businesses for managers and coworkers to blame an individual worker for lack of performance when really the problem is within the process or the problem is within a lack of resourcing of that individual to be successful or they just haven't been trained properly.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a break. When I come back more with Bill English, I'm going to give you another opportunity to weigh in on the conversation, 877-933-2484. If you have a question about failure or anything that's you want to process or you want to say, this is how I learned from it, that's valuable too. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. All right, 16 minutes after the hour, Bill English in studio, BibleandBusiness.com. And Bill, what was the question? Do we accept failure in others?
Yeah, we were talking during the break here, and that was one of the things we were talking about. Do we accept failure in other people, especially within the church? When somebody fails, maybe they're the leaning out spouse, and they're ready to leave the marriage, and they're on an impending failure here. How do we respond to them? If they're a person who has just caused all kinds of havoc and mayhem at work, and they've just been failing all over the place, mm-hmm. literally barfing all over the business, mm-hmm. and
great visual, you know, by the way.
And how do we view them? What do we do with that? I think as Christians, my experience is within the church, public failure is not handled well. It's not handled with grace. It's not handled with appropriate discipline, and people just get blamed. And I've seen people take sides in an impending divorce within a church, and they just can become downright mean and ungodly towards mm-hmm. the leaning out spouse, which all that does is just confirm in the leaning out spouse anyways, that this church doesn't really practice what it preaches, that this whole church thing is just a bunch of malarkey, mm-hmm. and I'm going to go down the road and find something that makes me feel good.
All right, let's dial it up here, Bill. Why do people fail in business and in life?
Yeah, why do they fail in business
why
and
do
in
they
life?
Fail?
Well, the most egregious is what I call deviance. They choose to violate a prescribed practice or process. Mm-hmm. You'll have employees who do that, coworkers who do that. They know what they're supposed to do. They just choose to do it differently.
Okay.
And that's just plain old deviance. Inattention is another one. People get distracted from what they're supposed to be doing, and they get, every shiny new thing. Mm-hmm. What's the Over the Hedge? Do you remember the movie Over the Hedge and the squirrel that was just darting back and forth everywhere? I view inattention like that.
Okay.
They just can't focus. Lack of ability is the third one. They fail not because they're not trying, but because they don't have the skills or the resources or the training to do the job correctly.
What about if they know they don't have the ability, they should have the ability, and now they're kind of hiding their inability from others because they don't want to appear incompetent?
Yeah, well, that's when you earnestly desire to accomplish a task for which you're not able to accomplish by simply doubling your efforts, there's no end to what you cannot do,
mm-hmm.
right?
So you go to a certain length at a job, and now you've gone too long. You can't ask what something is anymore.
Yeah, you've been able to hide it for a while,
really,
right?
Stupid, yes.
Yeah. Well, you better come clean because eventually you're going to be found out. Eventually it's going to surface.
Okay. How do you do that, by the way?
How do you do what?
What I just asked.
How do you come clean?
Yeah, especially if you've, in the radio business, you go, we have a hard break at 29 minutes after. And I go, yeah, I got a hard break. What's a hard break?
What's a hard break?
Yeah. You've been in this job for a year. You don't know what a hard break is? So yeah. At what point do I go, I don't want to look too stupid.
You know, believe it or not, you remember Brett Favre,
yeah.
quarterback Favre. Favre?
Yeah.
Favre is what he said, wasn't it?
That's something, yeah.
And they did an NFL Football Life on Brett Favre,
mm-hmm.
and he said that he was out there playing professional football, and he said they kept talking about, at least within the team meetings, they kept talking about a nickel defense and a nickel this yeah. and a nickel that. He finally went to his number two quarterback and said, what are they talking about when they talk about nickels, right?
That's crazy.
You know, and there he'd been out there playing professional football
right.
and didn't even know the terminology.
There you go. It's a perfect illustration.
You just got to come clean and say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. And even though I've been doing it for a while, I mm-hmm. need to improve. I need to get better. So help mm-hmm. me help
I think
me
that's
out
a
here.
Big problem, Bill. I got to tell you, in companies across this fine country, there are people that are not competent to be in a job. Yet because they don't want to be discovered, they continue to fake their way through stuff.
Yeah, they do. And that's why from a management standpoint, I like the Reagan mantra, trust but verify. Trust that what they're telling you is true, but then have systems in place that surface metrics on whether they're actually doing their job and what they're telling you is true. See if the metrics back up what they're saying. I've had a number of employees who would present to me that they're doing quite well and they're working really hard, and then you get behind the scenes. You can go and look at their emails. You go look at their phone call logs and other stuff, and you find out they're not working very hard at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that a lack of skill? Is that inattention, lack of ability? I don't know, but they're failing, and they're not willing to admit it, and they're not willing to ask for the coaching.
Okay.
That's actually, but by the way, when you stop to think about it, coaching, when you ask for coaching, what you're saying is, I'm not at the place I need to be, and I need someone to help me get better.
Mm-hmm.
In the church terms, that's discipleship.
True.
Coming under the discipline of somebody else, presumably the Holy Spirit and another person, so that you become more than who you are today and so that you grow in your sanctification and holiness.
Mm-hmm.
And how many of us raise our hands and say, me, I want to be disciplined. Me, I want to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very few people do that.
Yeah. Well, I agree you need to be disciplined, so thank you for suggesting that.
Well, you're welcome. Yeah. I'll talk to you after the show.
All right, but I'm just trying. I'm drilling down on this one, Bill, because this is interesting to me, because when you are not competent or you don't have the skills or resource or the training and you continue to fake your way through stuff and all of a sudden stuff comes out sideways because it has to.
It has to.
So you start becoming sarcastic or you start, you know, distancing yourself from people because I can't let you into my zone and have you discover that I'm incompetent.
Yeah, and that actually exacerbates the problem.
Of course it does.
What you need to do is go to your manager, go to your coworkers and say, look, I need help in these areas.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a vulnerability there to where, you know, you might think, well, they're going to think that I'm not worth keeping on, or they're going to make fun of me, or they're going to be disgusted with me.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is they're going to be that way eventually with you if you do try to hide it all.
Mm-hmm.
So you might as well come clean, be vulnerable, and handle it in a professional way.
Mm-hmm. Are there some buzzwords in business that get abused because they can be? Like, I don't know, teamwork maybe?
So,
let's say Rebecca's not doing her job and she goes, well, can't you do it? Because we're a team.
We're a team.
Yeah. I go, wait a minute. Isn't that kind of your job description?
But, teams,
but if we're a team, we should all be happy about doing everything, right?
No, absolutely not. A team is made up a group of, in my estimation anyways, is made up of a group of people with certain competencies. And the sum of the competencies is the team. Not every person on the team can do every competency, nor should they.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I tell business owners, figure out what you're good at and then hire around you for your weaknesses.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Because the management team or the leadership team as a whole leads the organization, not just the owner or the CEO.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's keep down this very impressive list you've organized.
Okay. Process inadequacy would mm-hmm. be the fourth one. A competent,
what does that mean?
A competent individual. This individual is competent, but they have a faulty process. And so when they do what the process tells them to do, it leads to failure.
Okay.
So you have a process that doesn't work. Task challenge. Sometimes the task is simply too complex or difficult to be executed each time reliably. Sometimes, if you're asking people to jump on one leg and rub their stomach and pat mm-hmm. their head all at the same time, that would be a complex task that most people couldn't do mm-hmm. indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to end up failing at that. Uncertainty, the lack of clarity about future events causes people, this is a big one by the way, in business and in life. Lack of clarity about future events causes people to take present time actions that have undesired results. Especially in business, if you don't have clarity on what the job is, what their measurements are, and where the business is going, people fill in the blanks. They will naturally fill in the blanks, and they will act on what they think is their version of the truth, and you'll almost always get undesired results mm-hmm. as a result of that. Last, role uncertainty. Many people have to work together in a single process or in a team, as you just mentioned, to achieve results. Yet because they don't have good responsibilities or authorities or decision-making powers that are clearly articulated among the team, you end up with conflict and then you end up with failure.
Is that the beach ball theory of business?
I don't know what the beach ball theory is.
The beach ball theory is, there's all these multicolors on a beach ball, but I only see my color. I don't see the whole ball. I just see my color, and that's all I care about.
Yeah, you get that a lot in business.
Yeah, I would think so.
You get that a lot in business, and what you need are people who know their job but understand how their job affects other people and other processes in the organization
mm-hmm.
and that they care about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is good stuff, Bill. I we all have failures, so this applies to everybody, and then what we do with those failures and how we learn from them and how we can avoid them in the future because we've actually learned something of value is a good thing to think about and pray about and seek counsel about, right?
Yes.
Is sit down with someone and say, do I have blind spots? What am I missing?
And just last, I know the music's playing here, 10 seconds.
I don't hear it.
Go to God, on a regular basis, confess your sin, ask him how you're failing. He'll lovingly tell you, and he will transform your heart so that you are more like him.
Very good. Thank you, Bill English, BibleandBusiness.com. Let's take a short break, go to Breakpoint, and be back with more in just a minute. All right, we're back. It's 32 minutes after the hour. All right, let's go to news, and when we come back, we're going to have a very interesting conversation about the book of Ruth. You are absolutely not going to want to miss that.
Faith Radio is a media ministry of University of Northwestern St. Paul. Our mission is to lead people to Christ and to nurture believers in their faith through Christ-centered media. Tune in to Faith Radio to hear relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching, as well as interactive live talk programming. We love to hear from you, our listeners. Call into a live show or share how Faith Radio has impacted your life by calling the Faith Line at 877-93-FAITH.
Twenty-four minutes until the top of the hour. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to Carolyn Custis James about the book of Ruth, which I'm very excited about. But for the next minute, Gary Barkalow is going to talk about, as Christians, we believe that God has a plan for our lives. Sometimes it's just hard to see it.
When God takes us and puts us alone for a while with himself, and sometimes he can even, I think, mask his appearance of being distant, I think in that time, there's a couple things going on. One, I think he's trying to help us understand that our life comes from him and not our calling. And I think that's hugely important, because when we walk in who we are, in our desires, in our glory, that is life-giving. I mean, it gives you energy and enthusiasm and excitement, and it's an amazing thing because you're walking in who you are. But I think we can get to a point where we make that our source of life. And when we do, I think he pulls it back and says, I'm not taking it away from you, but you've confused where life comes, and you think it comes from service or calling. So I think that's one lesson. And then I think the other one is, in obscurity, is he reintroduces us to ourself. I think often we become other people around us because of what they said, because of applause, because of criticism. And I think he pulls us way back and says, I need to reintroduce you to your real heart, because that's what you bring to the world.
If you want to hear that full interview from Gary Barkalow, go to myfaithradio.com. Check it out. After a very short break, Carolyn Custis James is my guest. She's already on our studio line. I cannot wait to talk to her.
Someone once said, children seldom misquote you. In fact, they usually repeat word for word what you shouldn't have said. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. You probably know what I'm talking about. When your kids were little, they blurted out things in public that you said in private. Well, that might not happen when the kids turn into teenagers, but be assured that they're still watching you, and in more ways than one, mimicking what you say and do. So if that's the case, how are you teaching your kids to live? How are you teaching them to talk? These are questions that mom and dads like you and me need to think about. Children seldom misquote you. In fact, they usually repeat word for word what you shouldn't have said.
Learn how to navigate your child's turbulent teen years with Mark Gregson's free course. Get instant access by visiting freeparentingcourse.com.
It is 20 minutes until the top of the hour. The book of Ruth really speaks into today's world with astonishing relevance. And on our studio line is author, speaker, and actually award-winning 2016 Book of the Year by Christianity Today called Finding God in the Margins. It's understanding the book of Ruth. She's on our program. Carolyn Custis James. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning.
I love your name, by the way.
You do?
Yeah. Tell me about the Custis part. Where does that come from?
That's my maiden name.
Okay. Love it.
That's my maiden name. But actually, it's a very historic name in our country because George Washington was married to Martha Custis.
I did not know that.
And she was Custis by marriage, and Robert E. Lee married her granddaughter, Mary Custis. And Arlington Cemetery has the Custis Lee Mansion. So,
wow.
But, you know, that's not the lot. I mean, we connect to that family up higher on the family tree. So, But anyway, I like to mention that.
I learn nothing when I talk. So thank you. All right, let's talk about the Book of Ruth.
Yes.
This is, I love the Book of Ruth, first of all, and I'm excited to read your book. I haven't read it yet, but I want to learn from you about some of the things that maybe I've never understood about the Book of Ruth. What have I missed?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, for me, the same question came up. I'm a pastor's kid, and I grew up in the church, and this was one of the stories I loved the most. And then about 20 years ago, I was sitting in a seminary classroom listening to one of the leading evangelical Hebrew scholars talk about the Book of Ruth. And I was, you know, I thought, I know this book back and forward. There's nothing I'm going to learn here. And I have to tell you, my whole life blew up when he started talking about it. You know, we've heard about it sort of like a Cinderella story.
Yes, we sure have.
Yeah, and one of the things that will change the Book of Ruth for us entirely is when, and every story in the Bible actually, is that when we open the Bible, we need to remind ourselves that we aren't reading an American book. And when we read it through an American lens, the Book of Ruth is going to turn into Cinderella, which is really hard to preach in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we're not living Cinderella stories, and a lot of people's lives are anything but a Cinderella story. But it's a book that's cast against the backdrop of the patriarchal world.
Mm-hmm.
And patriarchy becomes a very powerful tool for understanding the Bible when we see it as the backdrop to the story, not the message, but the backdrop, the cultural backdrop. So the Book of Ruth takes place in a patriarchal world that is full-fledged patriarchy. So it's a world where sons are prized and daughters really don't count. And, I mean, that goes to extremes in today's world. I just read an article where they say the combined populations between China and India, that in those populations there are 70 million more men and boys than there are women and girls. And that's because the girls are aborted when they do an ultrasound and see it's a girl, not a boy, and they want boys, or they neglect them when they're born, or they abandon them, or sometimes they outright kill them. So it's a dangerous situation in the world today because it means more violence, it means more sex trafficking. It's a crisis of, you know, human tragedy in terrible proportions. So that's the world that this story takes place in. It's a world where a woman's value is gauged by her relationships with men. It's who is her father or who is her husband. But the gold standard for measuring a woman's value is to count her sons. So, you know, the women in the Bible who are barren and are pleading with God, they're not pleading for daughters. They're pleading for sons.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the Book of Ruth and you say this is a world where men have power and privilege from birth and where women they don't have legal rights, they don't have agency, they don't have voice, they need a man in the family to give that to them because he has it. This story changes altogether because, and one of the things, this is my second book on the Book of Ruth, and this book was new layers of this book opened up because of current things that are going on. So take, for example, Naomi, you know, this professor and scholars are saying this today about the Book of Ruth. No, it's not a Cinderella story. This is the story of a female Job.
Mm-hmm.
So Naomi, the story opens talking about Naomi's family, and there's a famine, and they become famine refugees in Moab, which is today's Jordan, where there are lots of refugees. And, you know, knowing what we know about what life is like for refugees should help us understand more the beginnings of her sufferings. But what happens when they get there is her husband dies and she's widowed. But she's got double insurance with two sons. She's a woman who can hold her head up because she's done her duty for the family. The next generation is secure. She has two sons.
She's got some leverage still.
Sorry?
She still has some leverage.
Yes, and she has security because
yes.
of them.
Yes.
Okay, so they both marry pagan girls. And those two couples go through 10 years of double infertility, which is a total calamity because it means the family is being extinguished.
Mm-hmm.
There's no son. There's no next generation for the family. And that is like a woman's job is to produce sons to save the family for another generation. And then instead of a positive pregnancy test, what happens is both sons die.
Wow. All right. Carolyn, I think this would be a good place to break. When I come back, we'll resume our conversation with Carolyn Custis James, author of Finding God in the Margins, which is really an explanation of the Book of Ruth. We'll be back in a minute. We're back. It's 11 minutes till the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Carolyn Custis James. She's written a book called Finding God in the Margins. We're talking about the ancient Book of Ruth and how relevant it is today. Carolyn, right when we left off, Naomi just has lost her two sons.
Right. She lands at ground zero is what happens to her. Because it's the destruction of her whole life, and she's past childbearing years, so unlike Job, she doesn't get to start over.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that looms through the Book of Ruth is has to do with God's love, which is something we all wrestle with, because she feels like God has turned against her. And, you know, that's not a rare thought in the minds of Christians. When we go through terrible things, the question is, where was he? And that question is not answered through a prophet or a bolt of lightning or a vision or a voice. The question is answered through Ruth. And the question is answered through Ruth in her collaborations with Boaz. And, you know, in today's world, Ruth would be a Jordanian. She would be called Arab. She would be probably from a Muslim background in today's world. And she is undocumented in Israel. So she's like, and she's barren. She hasn't produced a child in 10 years. So no man in his right mind would be remotely interested in her as a wife. But she steps up and she fights for Naomi all the way through the book. And Boaz is a man of enormous power. I mean, he embodies male power and privilege. He's got it all in this story. And yet he is willing to listen to Ruth, and three times she reinterprets to him Mosaic law, which he was raised on and she's a newcomer to.
Mm-hmm.
But Ruth lives on the hungry side of the law. And the law reads differently from that point of view. The letter of the law says, let them glean, let them pick up the scraps in your field once you're finished clearing it. The letter of the law says, let them glean. The spirit of the law says, feed them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the discussion that they have. And every time Boaz gets what she's doing. And, you know, we think of this, of him as the guy who gets the girl, but he becomes the man who fights for Naomi. He gives her property rights which widows don't have in that culture. He gives her the right to own and sell property. He puts before the city council the demand that the nearest relative purchase the land, but also marries Ruth. Who says he has to marry Ruth? You know, it's not, that's not in the law. And yet Boaz just pushes it all through. And in the end, Naomi has a son that Ruth has born to Ruth and Boaz after they marry. She conceives a son. It's a miracle childbirth. And that son, and this is the part that I love about it and why, you know, I talk about God is in the margins, that Ruth and Naomi are complete zeros in the culture. If you count their sons, they're zeros. Mm-hmm. And yet God is moving his purposes forward through the for the world on their shoulders. And they don't even know it. You know, they think they're just, she's working to feed her mother-in-law, and she's working to rescue the family from extinction. But God is moving the line, the royal line, forward. I mean, this child that's born to her becomes the grandfather of King David, and that line leads to Jesus. Mm. So, I mean, it's you know, it's a reminder, I think, that we should never count anyone out. That sometimes we think God's doing things in the world through the big shots, you know, the big names and the famous people, and but God is more subversive than that. And he does work in the margins, and sometimes it's through someone the world wants to get rid of, like an immigrant or mm-hmm. a refugee. And yet, you know, we need to pay attention to what he's saying in his word about how he works
yeah.
and who matters. The story begins by ending, because it's two women who have no sons, and one is postmenopausal and the other is barren. And yet they are the ones God chooses.
Carolyn, let me ask you this, because, you know, if you're a godly man and you want to be a part of the solution in today's world, you know, Boaz is a pretty good example to look at, isn't he?
Oh, he's amazing. I mean, I look at him as this is a Me Too story that didn't happen. Because Ruth is at risk in his field. He has to tell the men not to touch her. And Naomi says, stay there because somewhere else you could be harmed. And when she goes to him in the dark of night and nobody's looking, and if it came down to he said, she said, no one would believe her. And this man, I mean, he is I think he's the most incredible man in the whole Old Testament. He has male power and privileges, and he uses them for enormous good and sacrificially. I mean, you know, male power and privilege are gifts.
Mm.
They're, you know, I mean, how's a man going to disempower himself or unprivilege himself? It's a trust that God gives his sons that can be used for enormous good. And he uses it all the way through the book to empower Ruth and to bless Naomi, and Naomi revives because of what they do for her.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, this is so interesting. I'm even thinking about just backing up to a woman outside the family of God, listening to this conversation and hearing about how patriarchal it was and how marginalized women were. And she might think, boy, that's not a book I want to read.
Oh, it's, you know, the value statements for women in this book are enormous. I mean, right from the beginning, there are two women the world would completely discard, and God is choosing them.
Beautiful.
And by the end of the book, Ruth is embraced. This is an undocumented immigrant. Before she gets married or has a child, the community embraced her at the highest level as one of Israel's highest matriarchs. You know, Leah and Rachel, and, you know, they don't give her a green card or extend her visa. They make her one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the women say to Naomi, your daughter-in-law is better to you than seven sons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in that culture, what kind of high praise is that?
Right. Carolyn, give me a second to do some simple math here. I've got 81. I have 82 more questions I have to ask you. So... And because we're completely out of time, would you be willing to come back on the program and continue this conversation?
I would love to.
Awesome.
I would love to.
I'll have you back.
Thank you.
In a short time. Carolyn Custis James has been my guest, Finding God in the Margins. We'll take a short break and wrap up the show. Thanks for listening to the show. Have a great day. I will see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.